Heads up, fans of the world. We're putting a little something extra in your feed. Things That Go Boom, a bonus podcast to loyal listeners of the world from PRX. Things That Go Boom. Let's roll.
In Texas, a family was shopping at Sam's Club, and from behind, the assailant slashed the family in the head, a two-year-old, a six-year-old, and the father.
The suspect thought the family was Chinese and infecting
said he thought they were Chinese. They were actually refugees from Burma.
At 1 a.m. on June 1st, a bunch of fake accounts started tweeting about a fire in D.C.
Hundreds of thousands of tweets about this topic, many of them suggesting that there was a communications outage for 6 hours in Washington, D.C.
So is the internet down? Is there a fire that's as tall as the Washington Monument?
The more ridiculous the claims, it seems, the more traction they gain on social media.
My wife was running on a trail, and she saw this person approaching her. She tried to step aside. He blocked her path and then coughed on her.
A surge of recent racist incidents against Asian Americans amidst the coronavirus pandemic.
As the disease continues to spread, fake news is going viral too.
People around the country were waking up to this hashtag DC blackout and seeing their capital in flames and maybe under siege.
They jammed our phones. They are shooting. A loud bomb was heard. I'm literally terrified right now.
There are a lot of conspiracy theories that, oh, it came from the dietary habits of Chinese, or it came from secret labs from China.
You had the theory from the lab. You had the theory from the bats. You know, the type of thing.
With all the protests going on, people have been out in the street. And this was an attempt to capitalize on the discourse around the anti-black racist movement and the Black Lives Matter movement.
When do you want it?
Chinese get racially profiled as being disease carriers, of being the source of the disease and bringing the disease.
Information operations are just about polarizing groups, sowing distrust, clouding the information space.
When the president used the term Chinese virus,
the Chinese flu, the China flu,
there was a spike in hate incidents afterwards.
Kung flu, yeah.
And the insistence of that usage inflames racism, and it led to the scapegoating of Asians in America.
I feel an animosity that I've never felt before.
And this kind of confusion and discord grows and breeds the distrust and disengagement that we are worried about.
I'm Lacey Healy, and on this episode of Things That Go Boom, we're going to talk about disinformation. Maybe you've heard of it. As coronavirus continues to spread throughout the U.S., so does false information regarding its origin, stoking underlying divisions and breeding hateful acts. At the same time, DC blackout, an incident that happened during the Black Lives Matter protests, provided us all with a real-life example of what happens when confusion is co-opted to create chaos. But did anyone listen? Disinformation has become a part of our everyday lives. And it's leading to something a whole lot scarier than the disinformation itself. It's leading to a lack of trust in the very institutions that uphold our democracy. Hey there. A quick favor. Things That Go Boom is conducting an audience survey, and we'd be so grateful if you could take just a few minutes and fill it out. If you're in, please visit survey.prx.org/boom to take the survey today. That's survey.prx.org/boom. Thanks. Before we jump into the deep end, let's have a little talk about this thing we call fake news.
And I want you all to know that we are fighting the fake news. It's fake, phony, fake.
What it is and what it isn't. There are two types of fake news, as it were. Disinformation and misinformation. Disinformation is the big one, because it means that people in groups are purposely spreading false information in an effort to change opinions or influence someone's actions or just create chaos, like DC blackout. We asked Mike Mazar to help us explain.
Yeah, okay, will do.
He's a senior political scientist at the RAND Corporation, a big policy think tank.
So there's all kinds of different categories. Kind of the baseline thing is social media campaigns.
that through a combination of fake and real Twitter accounts, fake and real Facebook accounts, accounts on other social media platforms, including some of the more dark web platforms like 4chan and 8chan, are designed to broadcast and amplify negative messages.
Extreme political narratives, sensational clickbait, conspiracy theories, that sort of thing.
So there's a certain kind of bulk broadcasting piece, and this is where some of the computational propaganda, as it's called, comes in, where they're bots, right? So they build artificial algorithm-driven accounts that are just programmed to grab certain kinds of messages and rebroadcast them, and they can achieve a certain amount of brute force that way.
Disinformation is not political nuance or bias in reporting. Like, often, when the president talks about fake news.
Well, the New York Times is fake news.
And as far as CNN going out of their way to build it up, BuzzFeed, which is a failing pile of garbage, you are fake news.
He is not talking about disinformation. Mostly, he's just talking about reporting he disagrees with. Actual disinformation and its consequences look more like Pizzagate. You might remember that in 2016, the personal email account of Hillary Clinton's campaign manager, John Podesta, was hacked as part of a Russian information operation. WikiLeaks published his emails, and that's where disinformation and misinformation took over. Conspiracy theorists falsely claimed that there were coded messages implicating Hillary Clinton in a human trafficking and child sex ring. The story took off on forums like Reddit and 4chan and was amplified by members of the alt-right. And eventually, it led one of those conspiracy theorists, an AR-15-toting dad from North Carolina, to bust into a DC pizza shop to break up the child sex ring he believed Clinton was running in its non-existent basement. Pizzagate is a great example because it shows how disinformation works alongside misinformation to spread fake news like wildfire. See, the folks who knew the Pizzagate rumor was BS but spread it around anyway in an effort to discredit the Clinton campaign were engaging in disinformation. But all those conspiracy theorists on Reddit and 4chan, well, a lot of them really believed it was true. So they shared it because, like, if rumors like that were true, that was really something other people should know, right? And in some ways, that kind of misinformation is even more dangerous because it blurs the line between fantasy and reality, especially in times of crisis.
We've seen throughout time that there are kinds of narratives that have consistently always done well in terms of fooling people with false information.
That's Cindy Otis. She's a former CIA analyst and disinformation investigations manager at a cybersecurity firm. She says those super successful disinformation narratives tend to go right for our gut.
The two primary emotions that tend to have the most success when they're used in disinformation narratives are fear and anger. So during heightened time periods of fear and concern and stress, disinformation is much more successful.
And none of this is new. Actually, fake news, misinformation, and even disinformation are as old as communication itself.
So Jack the Ripper is a really interesting study on how much fake news played such a role in how we perceive a person from history, even today.
It was the 1880s. London had experienced an influx of Irish and Jewish immigrants, and parts of the city had become overcrowded.
It was the largest city in the world. The British Empire was still a thing. You know, the city was going under quite a lot of change and was divided between the wealthy, the working class, and the very, very poor.
Economic problems were accompanied by social unrest, most famously Bloody Sunday in 1887. And the parish of Whitechapel on London's East End became increasingly known for, well, immorality. Poverty had driven many of the parish's female residents to prostitution just to survive. Then, in 1888,
a body of a woman was found.
Marianne Nichols.
And she was quite brutally murdered. There were a series of other murders of women, and it really shocked the middle and upper class sectors of London. Journalism was still a developing thing, and the newspapers of the time in London just went wild for this murderer and the whole sort of circumstances around it.
In Entire newspapers were devoted to covering these murders, and sales skyrocketed. But they weren't exactly doing due diligence.
So there were wild accusations, rampant rumors all across the country that traveled, you know, really all around the world about who this murderer could be.
Onlookers weren't worried about the women. They'd gotten themselves into it as far as the middle and upper class were concerned by becoming prostitutes. But they were worried about the unwelcome inhabitants of so-called outcast London.
And because of the undercurrent of racism at the time, a lot of the accusations were pointed at Jewish immigrants, to the point where newspapers were drawing racist cartoons of Jewish people, reporting the names of Jewish immigrants as possible suspects.
And it led to protests and violence against the immigrant community. People were scared, intrigued, and all too happy to find a scapegoat.
And the way that we think about Jack the Ripper now is almost like a monster, a boogeyman who's under your bed. And in large part, because of the chaos surrounding this event, we still to this day don't even know who did it, because there was just so much misinformation and rumors circulating.
Which, minus the brutal serial killer, might sound a lot like today.
And the 850 reports of harassment toward Asian Americans just this week.
There's a lot of parallels with sort of what we're seeing in the pandemic now about pointing the finger at marginalized communities as being the cause of the virus.
Being spit on or some coughing in their faces on purpose.
Wild accusations flying everywhere. It was that sort of frenzy that happened as well during Jack the Ripper.
Except that today, we have the internet. So news travels fast.
So fast. It can spread so fast.
And fake news? Well, someone once said a lie can travel halfway around the world while the truth is still putting on its shoes. But it's true. A couple of years ago, a study at MIT found that it took the truth about 6 times as long as a lie to reach 1,500 people on Twitter.
A new study shows Twitter users are way more likely to hit the retweet button on stories that are outright false.
But why would someone knowingly spread false information, you say?
It can be ideological, it can be for profit, it can be both. They're advancing their own cause and maybe politicians that they agree with, and then they're also making money from it because it is a very profitable, lucrative business line.
So lucrative that it's become a whole cottage industry.
Individuals and firms are popping up, tout themselves as PR firms. They might be digital marketing strategists. They might call themselves communications firms, consulting firms, cybersecurity firms even. But what they offer are actual disinformation for hire, you know, pay us X amount of money to run a troll farm for you.
These folks provide all sorts of fancy services, creating inauthentic accounts, fake websites, and algorithms to blanket the internet with false information.
When a person comes to the troll factory, they'll receive a list of topics that the factory is working on that day. That includes what event happened, and then what should be written about it, and to what emotional state the troll should bring the audience to.
So more and more of those are popping up all over the world, Eastern Europe, Southeastern Europe, Southeast Asia, and so on.
And some of the biggest players on the internet today are making the existence of these groups possible. In 2019, the Global Disinformation Index found that companies like Google and Amazon spend almost $250 million every year to run ads on sites that have been found to publish misinformation, which means that individuals and groups across the spectrum, from PR firms to get-rich-quick kids in Macedonia to state actors looking to sow discord, are hopping on the train and heading to the gold rush. Which brings us to the relationship that most Americans think of when we think of disinformation. When we come back, we'll talk about Russia. The 2016 election has become a major flashpoint in Americans' understanding of our relationship with Russia and our relationship with disinformation. There's just one problem. That understanding looks a little bit like the story of Jack the Ripper. Incomplete, biased, and in some ways, dangerously misleading. You know, just jumping right in. How long has Russia been using information warfare against the United States?
Well, you know, there's a big Cold War story to be told to start with.
That's Mike again. Now, we like stories over here, so go ahead and tell me that story.
During the Cold War, each side was competing for the allegiance and attitudes of people in a variety of countries that were major sources of competition, beginning in Europe and then throughout the developing world. And each of them, the Soviet Union a little bit in the lead, decided that information tools could be really useful in this regard, whether it was direct state propaganda, making films and other forms of entertainment that could be released in different countries, buying broadcasting outlets in various countries, and limited, of course, by the technologies at the time, there was this big propaganda effort. And particularly on the U.S. side, there was a great deal of concern that this was one of the lead ways in which the Soviet Union was going to be spreading communist propaganda.
When the Cold War ended, the propaganda war calmed down too. The U.S. and Russia both walked back their efforts, at least a little. But our relationship never really reached the heights some hoped it might. Instead, it sort of muddled along, with periods of great partnership, followed by regular downturns. One of the worst downturns kicked off in 2007.
Спасибо большое, уважаемая госпожа федеральный канцлер, господин Тельчик, дамы и господа.
Putin gives a famous speech in Munich where he really begins to try to broadcast the message that Russia is not being treated fairly by the West, that NATO enlargement is something that's continuing without any sense of Russian interests or views, that increasingly Russia is beginning to believe that there are those in the United States and the West who have a regime change goal toward Russia. And he begins talking about how Russia is not going to sit by and allow this to continue without a response.
Analysts started saying that the relationship between the U.S. and Russia had reached its lowest point since the Cold War in about 2008, after Russia's war with Georgia. And despite an attempt at what the Obama administration famously called a, quote, reset.
That's why I committed to resetting the relationship between our two nations.
The lows only got lower in the years that followed, with clashes over Syria's civil war.
The Russian government has condemned the United States after President Trump ordered the launch of dozens of cruise missiles against
Russia's invasion and annexation of Crimea.
President Obama speaking with Russian President Vladimir Putin, apparently pulling no punches, although it is unclear.
And, of course, Edward Snowden.
President Vladimir Putin saying today that fugitive NSA leaker Edward Snowden is in Moscow and Russia will not stop him from leaving the country.
So that whole backdrop is what's going on behind Russia's decision to pour a lot more resources and efforts into programs that are specifically designed to undermine faith and confidence in institutions in the United States and Western Europe, primarily to disrupt the operation of our societies and generally to weaken countries that Russia has come to believe view Russia as an adversary.
Putin did say that Russia wasn't going to sit idly by, and cyber aggression is just the type of plausibly deniable aggression that Russia loves. But because it mostly takes place in the shadows, the American public doesn't really take notice until 2016.
The Russian government meddled in the 2016 presidential election.
Organizations affiliated with Russian intelligence were responsible for the hacking of the DNC.
Defendants allegedly conducted what they called information warfare.
2 months later, Donald Trump wins the presidency.
Had that not happened, I think the discussion today of Russian information operations would be in a very different place, even given a lot of their other social media campaigns. But of course, that really put it on the front page.
And generally, that seems like a good thing, right? Americans now know that they need to be aware of the general threat that Russian disinformation poses to our democracy. And many folks are even starting to understand that it's not just Russia. Iran, North Korea, China, and others are in on it too to varying degrees. But even though it might be easier to blame our adversaries and to look for a simple, perhaps even aggressive solution to the problem, Mike says it's not that easy. He says all of these disinformation campaigns are only working so well because they're exploiting our own problems right here in America.
It's an analogy to the Cold War. If somebody in Moscow in 1983 had said, look, the U.S. Information Agency is trying to get, you know, the Poles to believe that our system doesn't work, the answer would have been, and in fact, Gorbachev eventually said this, right, it's not the American propaganda that's convincing them it doesn't work. It's the fact that it doesn't work that it's convincing them it doesn't work. And it's the same in our society.
Which brings us back to Jack the Ripper and the slurs used to describe coronavirus and the D.C. blackout that never happened. While this might not exactly be Cold War Russia, there is something deeply structural within our country that is not working. and our most vulnerable and marginalized communities are being hit the hardest.
I'm Camille Stewart. I'm the head of security, policy, and election integrity at Android and Google Play.
You might remember Camille. She told us the DC blackout story right at the beginning of the episode. Well, she also told us that the narratives of the disenfranchised are some of the best weapons our adversaries have when they set out to launch a disinformation campaign.
These folks are a target because disenfranchised communities, when you either manipulate their narratives or play into those narratives in a way that's inauthentic, that increases polarization, means that those disenfranchised folks feel further disconnected, further disenfranchised from the majority, and it can cause them to disengage or to be a susceptible ear to things like radicalization.
Those narratives also deepen existing divides between the far right and the far left.
And then those two sides are further at odds for yet another issue and is polarizing and politicizing something that is inherently apolitical and then makes these things hyper-inflammatory.
No justice! No peace! No justice! No peace!
And we don't even need to look to the most egregious examples of disenfranchisement in our country, like racial tensions. I mean, veterans tend to feel disenfranchised when they come back, and they are a key target for a lot of Russia's disinformation campaigns. We see it in immigrants, especially in Latino communities around the census, but then that also permeates to voting. So we need to be thinking about all the groups that we are disenfranchising and how they are targets.
I'm Russell Jung, Chair and Professor of Asian American Studies at San Francisco State University.
You might recognize Russell from the top of the show, too, where he told us how his wife was coughed on during a run and how in the midst of a pandemic, this exact scenario, this marginalization and disenfranchisement of certain communities is playing out.
Large percentages of Asian Americans are really afraid to go out because of fear of racial bias. Asian Americans and African Americans have the highest rates of fear of being discriminated against now at this moment.
And he's worried it's only going to get worse.
Since it's a central campaign theme, since we're sheltered in place longer, and since the pandemic is surging again, and because people are getting more and more angry, we just feel that this continued scapegoating of China and Chinese people will lead to more hate.
But like so much of this crisis, the racism that's come to light as a result of coronavirus is much bigger than this moment in time. It's deeply ingrained in our history and our collective American psyche.
This ultra-nationalism really stirs up an us versus them approach towards immigration and immigrants or outsiders. And so that's part of the stereotype of Asians, that we're perpetual foreigners, that we're a yellow peril, you know, coming in to threaten and endanger the West. And so nationalism just sort of stokes up those yellow peril fears again. And so, you know, there's some underlying issues that we have. Are pretty foundational to our system.
As whole swaths of the country put their lives on the line in the middle of a pandemic to march for Black lives, whole other swaths have refused to be governed, surfacing our deepest divides in the middle of one of the worst crises we've faced. There are parts of the country today that don't believe coronavirus is real. There are larger parts that don't believe it's a threat. And that's not just a result of disinformation. In some cases, it's coming straight from the top.
As COVID rages, President Trump does not see the threat as a firestorm.
Cases are up. Well, cases are up. Many of those cases shouldn't even be cases.
If we don't come together as a nation with national leadership, we will see more people die.
Many of those cases are young people that would heal in a day. They have the sniffles and we put it down as a test.
But President Trump does not acknowledge the surge in serious cases or the slowness of testing.
He claims testing itself makes the situation appear worse.
When you do testing to that extent, you're going to find more people. You're going to find more cases. So I said to my people, slow the testing down, please. They test and they test.
America is facing a crisis of belief. Significant portions of the public are questioning guidance from the very institutions and officials they've elected to help keep them safe. And if we're going to address this problem, our elected officials have to stop feeding into it. Here's Cindy again.
There's a huge responsibility for political leaders in every country to understand and acknowledge that they have a responsibility to provide the most accurate information, regardless of political ideology, regardless of their election prospects, that there are long-term consequences to being part of the misinformation and disinformation system.
But this isn't just some far-off threat looming years in the future. Camille says, just imagine, Election Day 2020 comes along in the middle of COVID-19, and we're dealing with added confusion, possible voter suppression, maybe mobile and online voting. We're emotional. We're afraid. And we need to consider that we might not get the election results right away.
There is a real possibility that we won't. We most likely won't. You know, apps break all the time, systems crash a little bit, people have to hand count some things this time because the infrastructure is a little different. Or if there is something like an app going down for a little bit, a website going down, folks trying to speculate as to what happens.
Which is exactly what happened during the Iowa caucus, when a brand new app failed and ended up delaying the election results.
Millions of dollars invested, all for an application that appeared to be beta testing using Our Democracy.
And having that on a national scale on our actual election day, I think, is my fear for some kind of information operation influencing how folks feel about our election on November 3rd or even in the weeks to come after that, because there was just a cloudiness in the information space and people just can't trust it.
There's also some possibility that the opposing side might question the results, leading some citizens to question whether their leader was elected fairly, the kind of question citizens tend to ask in countries that aren't fully democratic.
The consistent erosion, the lack of clarity, has a toll, a heavy toll, and can change our democracy in ways that we don't intend. Like, we as American citizens should be able to dictate how our democracy evolves and not have it dictated by outside influence that is really just trying to muck it up.
But our focus on Russia and others as the sole source of the problem can also be a distraction.
So I do think fundamentally this is a domestic issue to be addressed.
That's Mike Mazar again.
And if somehow, through a variety of reforms and steps, we were able to make progress on issues of political polarization, social equality, and social justice, the effect of the Russian actions would be vastly less than whatever it is now.
It might not be the most satisfying or even immediate answer to this problem, but every expert we spoke to agreed that change begins with us. Because more than any other national security challenge, disinformation is primarily a people issue. It's people who create the disinformation and misinformation, it's people who spread it, and it's people who have to be the first line of defense against it. And we all have to do better before it's too late. Things That Go Boom is produced by Inkstick Media and distributed by PRX. Our show is produced by Ruth Morris, Marin Lazian, and me. Darian Shulman composes our music, and our engineer is Robin Wise. Thanks to John Barth for his editorial support. And thanks to the foundations that make our work possible. The Carnegie Corporation of New York, MacArthur Foundation, N-Square, and Plowshares Fund, as well as Inkstick supporters, including the Colomb Foundation, Prospect Hill Foundation, and the Jubitz Family Foundation. If you like the show, come visit us on social at Inkstick Media for a look at the rest of the work that we do. We'd love to see you there. And hang in there. We'll see you in 2 weeks.
And ultimately, I think that's one of the reasons for my optimism about this. If Stakeums is on the side of the angels, then how could we possibly lose?
That's exactly. That's a perfect place to end for me.
Okay.
Thank you so much.
From PRX. From PRX.